Today on Against the Grain. Recent political discussions of marriage have revolved around who should be allowed to wed. But missing from most debates is the question of the unfair privileges conferred by the institution of marriage itself. Scholar Jacqueline Geller discusses the more than 1,000 benefits accorded married people at the expense of the non-married. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Why is it that as Americans are marrying less, laws that benefit married people are getting stronger, including in the wake of the legalization of gay marriage? And why is it that those who are not married are often unaware of the myriad ways they subsidize the married? In Moving Past Marriage, Why We Should Ditch Marital Privilege, End Relationship Status Discrimination, and Embrace Non-Marital History, Jacqueline Geller shines a light on the social, cultural, and economic costs borne by those who do not marry. She hopes non-married people will start understanding themselves and acting as an oppressed group with common interests. Geller is Associate Professor of English at Central Connecticut State University. Jacqueline, you're a scholar of 18th century literature. Can you tell us how has the Western conception of marriage changed in the, broadly speaking, modern era?
I have to preface this by saying that when you make large sweeping historical statements, you inevitably make mistakes. But to make meaning, you have to be willing to speak in broad terms. So one has to generalize, you know, a little bit. The 1960s and 1970s in this country saw a wide cross-generational, cross-gender, cross-race questioning of the marriage construct. The marriage construct meaning a very self-contained nuclear family living in a very private and self-interested way as an economic unit, with making people within the family its priority. Not even the architecture of suburbia reflects a very radical privacy and a very radical kind of familial isolationism, where there aren't even porches, which were a common 18th, 19th century thing, where, you know, people could sit outside and wave at their neighbors, let's say. That was all shifted to the backyard, where people could see only their immediate relatives. It was a one wage earner, usually the male, and a domestic caretaker who was also somehow specially gifted with child-raising abilities and had strange intuitions and psychological abilities to shape children into good people and also to establish standards of taste in the household. So that was the 1950s model, broad strokes. And never before in Western culture or in American history had so many people across the races, across the regions, across the religions, bought into that model. It was the consensus was this was the good life. The pop psychology movement and psychiatry supported that, and cinema supported it. Unmarried people were thought of as deviant, bachelors immature, stunted, crushed by an excess of mommy love, women either pathetic and bitter or sluttish and promiscuous, and sometimes both, but they had somehow been left out in the game of musical chairs. When people started questioning this, as the gay rights movement did, the women's movement did, and other people did, they were told that they were questioning tradition. And this is one of the great ironies of marriage history. This was not a traditional model. There was no way, quite simply, throughout the first couple of thousand years of Western history, not to mention the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, that one person could support a whole household. Everyone had to work, including children. So for economic reasons, this was the result of a boom, of a post-war economic boom and a tremendous amount of government subvention. And my parents both had their college tuitions paid for completely, including travel and textbooks. I mean, this was a very, very particular situation. So, and people buying houses at the age of 21 or 22 with long mortgages was something that nobody did in the 700s and 1700s and 1800s. Homeownership was something you did much later. So part of the kind of waxed relationship we have to history is that we look at the 50s, which was very modern, very recent in history, and very radical, as traditional, and it's not. Traditional Europe, I'll just say it quite simply, from the early Christianization of Europe, which took place when Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, converted to Christianity in the 4th century, and then sent missionaries out throughout Europe, including England, it valued most highly celibacy. And chastity. People took vows of virginity. They took oaths of friendship. There were beguinages later on, where women who left their marriages to live together in chastity and to work on behalf of lepers who were outcasts and said to be punished by God and weren't allowed to enter cities. They could only beg from the outskirts of cities. So these Beguins, who were not nuns, but they were like sort of nuns, they found leprosaria where, you know, lepers could live and go to church and have medical care and have food. The chaste, pious Christian life from the monk and monasticism started, you know, very early in classical antiquity. It started in the East and it moved west, and it became very popular. To the nun, to the Christian mystic, like Hildegard of Bingen in the 8th century, in I think the 8th or the 9th century, the German nun who saw visions and wanted to be an anchorite and live in a cell and just recite the Psalms all day. This was the highest life that you could live. Marriage was a poor person's compromise. And it was something that was very discouraged. Even St. Paul, in his letters, said, you know, if you have to get married, I guess, you know, kind of, but really you should be like me, you should be celibate, you should be chaste. And he was a Jewish man who had converted to Christianity and became kind of the architect of Christianity. It's really hard for us, Sasha, to imagine this, because we think of people who would want to be celibate for their whole lives as psychologically disturbed. But this was... we kind of have reversed the traditional ideal by making sex and sexualized marriage and institutionalized eroticism the sign of mental health, you know, to the point where I sometimes Google my book and it cracks me up. There it is, Moving Past Marriage on Amazon, and underneath it will say, there'll be like five titles: How to Keep Your Marriage Hot, How to Stay Attracted to Your Partner After 20 Years of Marriage, How to Keep the Sex Alive After the Kids Come. And I'm thinking, wow, these are such different standards than our ancestors would have had. This all kind of changes in the Reformation in 1517, when Luther says, look, nobody's really celibate, nobody can do it. Even the brothers, you know, they can't do it. So let's just have clergy marry, and things start to shift toward the modern ideal that we have now. But I guess my answer would be marriage for moneyed people, people of means, was simply a way of transferring assets, forging familial alliances, keeping money within a household, property within a household, and generating heirs, hopefully male heirs, was always the ideal. And I don't think the whole like spice up your marriage, stay in love with your spouse rhetoric would have completely baffled our ancestors.
You know, moving from that longer sweep of history to the present, how would you characterize the valorization of marriage right now in U.S. society? What are the rates of participation in marriage in the society?
I think there are two simultaneous trends. I think the marriage rates are getting lower, and the overall interest in marriage is declining. But I think that the marriage policies and subsidies and benefits are getting stronger, and there's a lot of marriage incentivization, some of it government subsidized, because in a somewhat alarmist response to that. So, breaking it down, I think the divorce rates have been at about 50% for a long time. Some people will quibble and they'll say it's 48%, it's 51%. There isn't a standard answer to how many people get divorced, but it's around 50%. That's really different than even after World War I, when it was really low, like, you know, I don't, under 10%. The average marriage, so after World War I, was coterminous with child rearing. When someone left home, the one spouse tended to die a couple of years after that. So there wasn't this 30-year period where you're supposed to maintain a sparkling love affair after the kids are gone. I think that divorce has lost its stigma. I think that a lot of people get divorced and it's not considered a failure. It's considered a transition. One of the women that I interviewed for my book, Sylvia Beckerman, who I call a life space pioneer, is not particularly anti-marriage, but when she got divorced, she gave away all her stuff and she threw a divorce party, which is becoming a more and more common thing. And she invited all her close friends and she registered not as a bride, but as a divorcee, and asked people to get her all the things that she wanted and needed. And I think that's wonderful, because it's saying, you know, married people aren't the only ones that should get gifts and be subsidized. So there's celebrities are having divorce parties. People like Gwyneth Paltrow are talking about conscious separation. I know her mother, Blythe Danner, has said that Chris Martin, the musician, her son-in-law, is not her former son-in-law. He'll always be her son-in-law. In fact, he'll always be her son. My parents got divorced after a pretty unhappy marriage and then have remained best friends. They talk every day. They have dinner every week. So I don't, you know, I think that we're seeing a much more forgiving view toward when one style of relationship doesn't work. A couple can transition into another style of relationship that might work for them. Michael Wald, the most esteemed expert on divorce in the country, has shattered all the work of Judith Wallerstein, who was a total fraud, who wrote The Impact of Divorce and talked about how children of divorce were doomed. And he has simply concluded from all his research that it really has no impact on people at all long term. It has one impact, which is economic, but it doesn't determine your whole life or turn you into a commitment phobe or a needy person or an introverted depressive. All of that was a bunch of hysteria. In general, millennials are not just less interested in being married; they're dramatically less interested in even living with a romantic partner. Many of them say they would prefer to live with friends. So we're seeing, definite shifts in those attitudes. But at the same time, in 2000, a movement self-consciously named the marriage movement sprung up, largely in response to all of these trends. And it was headed by Barbara Defoe Whitehead, Waite and Gallagher, who wrote The Case for Marriage, Michael Medved, the Republican psychologist, and his marriage-promoting wife, Diane Medved, Belinda Luscombe, who writes for Time magazine, buys into a lot of their rhetoric. And basically, The Case for Marriage was their Bible. And it said that basically everyone who isn't married is doomed. Married people have a monopoly on wealth, health, they get less cancer, they get less depression. Married men are taken care of by women who sort of interestingly seem to spend all their time in the kitchen. Married women have higher status, which of course is true, but they shouldn't. They have much better options for healthcare, which of course is true, but why should marriage be the gateway to health insurance? It's not in Australia, it's not in Canada, it's not in Tasmania, it's not in most civilized countries, it's not in Sweden. So they gave an argument that really begged the question, and it is that marriage gives you all these benefits, so you should get married to get the benefits because marriage is beneficial, which is a logically fallacious argument. But this is a powerful book. It was very popular. It remains cited even by academics, to my embarrassment.
And I'd like to return to those boosters of marriage, those who are promoting marriage as necessary for not just economic health, but, emotional well-being. But it's certainly the case, and you argue this in your book, that marriage actually does confer all sorts of benefits, over 1,000 benefits. Whether or not they're fair, they are certainly being conferred. And so people who are married do actually have economic benefits that they get. So I'd like to ask you about some of those, how in this society, basic rights are tied to marriage. Can you talk about healthcare and health insurance? How is health insurance by the state? So this isn't just, the ideology of people on the right promoting the family, but how does the state reinforce the centrality of marriage and, in effect, disenfranchise people who are not married?
Well, I think it's a really great question. And it's sometimes the number of benefits are so overwhelming that it can sometimes be hard to start. So I'd like to name what I think are the really important ones. And I'd like to just add as a kind of a preface or a prologue, marriage matters less legally in many other countries. We are way behind. We're a puritanical country. We were founded by Puritans who came here. And if a married person was in the community and had left a spouse back home, they sent that person back home. That was the policy of to be with their spouse. Spousal separation was considered that dangerous, that a single person could not be tolerated. It was illegal for single people to live alone in the early Puritan settlements. So we have a legacy that other nations don't have, and it is with us until today. So I think that the first thing that I found that was really startling when I set out to do my research just came from personal life. I have worked since I was 18. Every paycheck takes Social Security and automatically. It's my money, but I understand it goes into a savings account. I think it's a good program. I think it served us well. And I assumed that I could name a beneficiary. So I set out to name a beneficiary for my Social Security if I predecease my sister by another mister. She's my best friend, and I call her my sister. We're not biologically related, but I've always been her children's legal guardian, and she's probably the closest person to me. I thought who would be really affected if I died young? It would be her. Not my boyfriend. It would be her. I mean, he would be, obviously. But and I found out that I couldn't name anybody as a beneficiary because I'm not married. And this was a little bit startling to me. And I said, but I've been with this woman for much longer than most marriages. So you're saying if I married someone that I knew for a week, I could name that person as a beneficiary? Yes, it's all contingent on marriage. Gets worse. My payments go right back into the system. So all the money that I've paid, and it's been, you know, a significant amount by now. I'm a professor, and all the way through my teaching assistantships, which were wretchedly paying, and then the lectureship, which paid a bit better, and then my professorial salary. But even before that, when I waitressed, I mean, anything that I earned in the form of a paycheck, Social Security was automatically deducted. It wasn't optional. So all of that goes to subvent and support married couples. And if you're married to someone for 10 years, even if you divorce, you can access that person's Social Security. So let's take Newt Gingrich, not my favorite man. A huge marriage proponent. He wants there to be cooling off periods, waiting periods for marriage, every obstacle put in divorce that you could put in front of people who want to separate and end unbearable relationships. He wants to stop them. He feels very, very comfortable doing that. He has been divorced several times, not surprisingly. Wife number one was with him for over 10 years. Wife number two was with him for over 10 years. Wife number three, I think, is still with him. If he predeceases these three women, they can all attach his Social Security benefits. So he can have three beneficiaries who I'm subsidizing with my money. And they don't have to have worked to have paid a dime into the system. I've worked my whole life. And I've not married, and yet my Social Security payments go to support his spouses and ex-spouses. And, you know, what Nancy Polakoff says, who's a law professor in Washington, D.C., is that the system is set up on a 1950s model, and it quite simply is set up to subsidize the spouses of high-earning men, or now I would say of high earners. There are plenty of high-earning women who support men. So that's one thing. And this is a federally run program. For some reason, non-married people are expected to smile, purse our lips, and sit quietly while our money goes to subsidize others' benefits. Second thing is a little dicier, and this is health insurance. Again, in the 1970s and the 1980s, certain companies started to recognize the fact that while people sometimes wanted to live together, they didn't want to necessarily marry. And this was for different reasons. They thought that marriage violated the ideal of governmental neutrality. They thought that they had been blessed with several life partners, and it seemed wrong to elevate one relationship above all others. They didn't like the blood-soaked sexist history of marriage, which goes back to Mesopotamian law, where men, they don't own women. That's wrong. They own their reproductive and sexual capacities. I could go on. Some people simply didn't think they were monogamous. They wanted to live with someone and have consensual non-monogamy. Others were just ceremonies didn't suit their taste, but they wanted to live with someone as a romantic partner, but they did not, and maybe even raise children, but they did not want to be married. And so companies like IBM, you know, a pretty conventional company, Oberlin College, my alma mater, the Village Voice in New York, Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, they began giving what were called domestic partnership rights or civil partnership rights, and giving insurance, health insurance, and all those benefits, including FSAs, to domestic partners. And you know, you'd fill out a form, and it would say domestic partner, civil union, but it wasn't necessary to show a marriage certificate. My school had that. The CCSU, where I teach, had that. after Obergefell versus Hodges, after the Supreme Court protected legally as a constitutional right gay marriage, companies immediately began yanking those benefits. And the two that I know that are large companies that took them away are Verizon, which employs, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and Corning. And there were many, many others, including my school. So suddenly, the argument became, and it was probably, Sasha, it was probably financially motivated, but the argument became everyone can get married now. So there's no reason to have civil partnerships or civil domestic benefits. There's no reason to give faculty subsidized housing who are cohabiting but not married. Just get married. And it was a very unfortunate reactionary move. And it left those of us who had hoped that we would have a non-marital option with nothing. So that when my boyfriend did get sick a couple of years ago, long COVID, I called my HR department and I said, I need to put him on my health insurance. We've been together for, you know, 10 years and much longer than most married people. And she said, oh, just get married and then come in. And once you're married, bring me the change of life circumstance. And I said, no, we can't do that. We're not doing that. We've talked about that. He's my domestic partner. And she said, oh, but ever since the gay rights decision came down, we immediately yanked domestic partnerships. So look, you get married and you come in 2 weeks. And I said, no, you're not hearing me. Being married would violate every ethical precept that I hold, and everything that's good about our relationship stems back to us not being married. We can't, that I'm not going to do. I'm asking you to make an exception. I'm a hardworking, productive, in terms of my scholarship, member of this faculty. I've been with someone a long time, more than most of my married colleagues have been married. Can you please put him on just to, so we can go to the doctor? You know, because he was in between jobs. And she said, no. So a lot of gay and straight and bi people are finding themselves in this situation where it's become kind of a trap. I've compared it in conversation to what if we told, you know, the big movement in the 1970s with second wave feminism with safe birth control and abortion, what if we told, and that was an important movement, to get those rights. What if we told Roman Catholic nuns that they had to wear IUDs? What if we told gay women that they had to go on the pill? You know, what if we told people who were consciously celibate that they had to start getting fitted for diaphragms? I mean, it's not a right when your hand is forced. It's a right when you are choosing it. So I guess that's the second thing would be the health insurance has deteriorated since Obergefell versus Hodges. And
yeah, and just before you go further, I wanted to ask you if with the legalization of same-sex marriage, was that an unanticipated consequence, the elevation of marriage, or did critics see that coming and speak out about it as it was unfolding?
The leaders of the gay rights movement, Evan Wolfson, the same-sex marriage godfather, Andrew Sullivan, Jonathan Rauch, all these people were extraordinarily right-wing in their views when you hear them talk. Evan Wolfson's big word was dignity. Marriage gave people dignity. And his organization is called Respect Marriage. I don't think he didn't know, because he's a shrewd Harvard-trained lawyer, that when you say you give a group of people dignity, you say that the opposing group does not have dignity. He said without marriage, gay relationships had no dignity. I am frankly offended by that. Rauch went further. He said that when gay marriage goes through, we have to go back to a 50s mentality where if a man doesn't have a husband by the time he's 35, he should expect to be shamed. He should expect to be pressured by his family. We should discourage all non-marital sex. He said this, and I appreciate that he said it because he sounded so ridiculous that at least he was being honest. Andrew Sullivan used a different word, another 1950s word was maturity. He said gay people had been in an arrested state of development from not having marriage, and gay men and lesbians, bi people, had been denied the sublime heights of marital maturity, and that marriage not only makes you mature, but it gives you it not only indicates maturity, but it gives you the opportunity to become more mature. And this was said in The Mature Mind and other 1950s classics. Sullivan's argument is patently absurd. It is clear that you can, if this was true, you would recognize a married person immediately when they walked into a room by their great state of maturity, whether they were wearing a wedding band or not. And you could see immediately that they were sagacious, poised. They had it all together. So these leaders relied on the most vile and most servile cultural propaganda to move their case forward. And other same-sex activists were completely alarmed. And I can list them: Claudia Card, the actor Rupert Everett, Miriam Margolyes. She said the thought of calling Heather my partner wife, it would make us both vomit. There were the great arguer against this is the gay scholar Michael Warner, in his book The Trouble with Normal. And he simply cuts through the same-sex marriage argument like a hot knife through butter. And he, you couldn't be more pro-gay. And he is gay. And he basically was, he said, this is a normalization movement. Look at what the people who are arguing it are actually arguing for. They're also arguing for benefits only for the married. This was never the early gay rights movement. We wanted to make marriage less important, not more important. The great Brashi decision, which gave a gay man his partner's apartment, the lease on it, when he died of AIDS, said it's not because they're a couple, this was in New York State, it's because they're a family. They're each other's family. This man has died of AIDS, and his partner was with him the whole time. If that's not family, we don't know what is. And I thought that was, it has nothing to do with them being married or not. It's commitment and love and shared resources and shared values and shared friendship over time and devotion. Another person who was quite vocal was Professor John D'Amelio, a gay studies professor in the Midwest. I forget where he's teaching now, but he said this is going to be proved to be an unmitigated disaster. Columbia Law professor Catherine Franca said, "I don't mean to be a turd in the punch bowl, but there's going to be some really bad repercussions to this, and we have to really watch out what we're asking for." And I'm not saying that I don't understand wanting those benefits when you don't have them for this completely arbitrary reason, which is your sexual preference. But the fact is, the backlash and the incredible effects on people of all sexual orientations losing our rights, who are not going to ever marry, has been really awful. And another option that the community might have fought for could have been achieved the exact same result, which is what the French call PAX, which is an agreement that you sign that you're living with someone, you're cohabiting. It could be your cousin, your best friend, your aunt, your sister, a lover that you are non-monogamous with. As long as there's commitment, shared resources, and a purport, an intention of permanence, you can have that person's health insurance. You can have the equivalent of what French call Social Security. You can have the tax benefits, which are enormous. You can have all of those benefits. And it's for gay, straight, anyone. And that would have given, I think the gay community, the protections that people they so badly needed, that all non-married people so badly need, but that they had particular grievances with, I understand.
But doesn't this also raise the question of whether these basic rights, rights to health care, rights to having money in your old age, should be even tied to our connections to others? In other words, shouldn't these things be universal, and whether we get them because we're married or because we have some arrangement with a loved one, that all of those kind of fall short compared to the idea of having a universal safety net?
I think so. And I think it would be good if the government wasn't adjudicating relationships. And this, it had nothing to do with personal relationships. I don't think domestic and civil partnerships were a great answer, because they were basically modeled on marriage. They basically said, this is kind of like marriage. This is a pale facsimile of marriage, so we'll give you the subsidized housing or the health insurance, even though you're not married. You look like a married couple to us. I mean, that was the unspoken thing. And I don't think government should be regulating sexual or emotional relationships. However, there are times when it's unavoidable, Sasha, like with, you know, the third thing I was going to get to was family leave. So the American Family Medical Leave Act says that you can take paid time away from a job to care for a loved one who's in distress, let's say recovering from brain surgery or going to chemo, or having recovering from a car accident, and you can take a certain amount of time, and your employer cannot prevent you. It's a federal thing, but only if you're married, or if the person is your blood relative, like your child. I find this really offensive, because it says, first of all, that marriage is the only adoption into family that really matters when so many of us adopt people, but having adoptions that are friendship adoptions that are just as important, mentor adoptions. But I think in that case, you can't really separate the benefit from the relationship. People have communities that they live in, and when they are ill or in crisis, they need to call on those people, and those people should be allowed to leave work and for a few weeks or whatever, that have paid leave to care for them. So I don't see how that would work apart from people. There are times when I agree with you in principle, but I think that there are times when the human element is unavoidable. And when it's unavoidable, I just think we need to take marriage out of the picture. Because if you turn it on its head, if you flip the argument on its head, it becomes a very cynical thing. I'll marry to get these benefits. I'll marry to get health insurance. I'll marry to get to know that I'll have someone's social security that I can tap into. I don't have to really even like this person. And the amount of pragmatism versus feeling can't ever be really sifted out and measured. But we can't expect people in same-sex relationships to be any more principled than straight people. Everyone is going to be looking for that person, not only because we've been told through companionship marriage ideology that this is your other half, you're not really a complete person until you find your soulmate, all of the romantic rhetoric in the script, but because you feel, as you get older, a little vulnerable, and you want those benefits, you want those securities, and I think they should be completely separated from relationships as much as we can.
Jacqueline Geller is my guest. We're talking about moving past marriage, why we should ditch marital privilege and relationship status discrimination and embrace non-marital history. Her other books include Here Comes the Bride. So Jacqueline, what about social status? I mean, we could probably talk for hours about the benefits, the legal and economic benefits that married people get compared to the rest of society, right? And, you know, immigration rights, around employment, inheritance, taxation, you know, state and local laws, the list is extensive. But I wanted to ask you about the cultural benefits that the married get. How does status figure into all of this?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I have to be really honest with you. I think status is actually more important than the legal benefits. I think that status is everywhere. I think that there is an enormous status still attached to marriage, and it comes with anything from thrusting a diamond ring in someone's face and saying, "I'm married," and expecting accolades and shrieks of delight, to going and registering at a bridal registry for everything you want, because, as a woman at Bloomingdale's told me when I went undercover as a bride, "You're a real woman now. You should get what you want." And I said, that's quite a relief. But I think also the kind of, when I ask my students, my female students, "Will you get married?" You know, they say, "Oh yeah, yeah." I say, "Well, do you believe in it?" They say, no, I don't believe in it." But I say, "But you'll do it." "Yeah, oh yeah, yeah." And they, I think, have been really under the sway of somewhat, I call it first lady porn, but these pictures of first ladies. Michelle Obama was the high-flying, she was the new Jackie Kennedy. And after Jackie Kennedy, there was, I guess, Nancy Reagan. There are certain celebrity first ladies that capture the public imagination, and they become arbiters of national taste and of, you know, people dress like them. Everybody in the Kennedy era had the little brown haircut, Jackie Kennedy's haircut, the little pillbox hat. She was called a queen. The Obama image was powerhouse, although she had left her job to support her husband's campaign and put her law license on inactive status, and taken his name. Nancy Reagan was the ultimate doting wife. Her notes are frightening. They say things like, I can't live without you for another minute. I don't remember who I was before I met you. I mean, she sounds to me like she's needs the neurological intervention when I read the notes that she wrote to Ronnie, her hubby, who wrote similarly unhinged notes. It would seem to me that their senses had become disordered, because they would write things like, if I'm without you for another minute, I'll die. I mean, so these are people to whom young Americans are supposed to form imaginary filial bonds. And what they show is that if you want access to the quarters of power, if you want to get a high profile, if you want to be a beautiful dresser, if you want to be glamorous, if you want to be admired, you will marry. I mean, all of these women's social standing comes from their being married. I think Jill Biden is a little less of a sensation than any of the three that I've just mentioned, although she certainly has been given beatifying portraits in the press as this wonderful wife and this wonderful stepmother. I think status comes in other forms. I was very surprised when I was looking for car insurance. I have an impeccable record as a driver, to find that there were insurance companies like McLean Insurance Company, I'll just name the one that I found, that said, "You may not feel like a whole new person when you're married, but we consider you to be a whole new person, starting a new life with a new identity. We give married people special rates." And there's no records that show that married people drive better. We do know that younger people have more accidents than older drivers, which should not be surprising, because older drivers are more experienced. But that would make sense. But the idea of giving married drivers special rates and all kinds of little package gifts and things when you're not even a you don't even have a record of being a safer driver is kind of absurd to me. And there are, you know, just tons of ways that I think being a couple since the Reformation has given you, has given status.
Well, Jacqueline Geller, I'd like to end by asking you about how something could change. You write in your book about the need for people who are not married to recognize themselves as actually a force and with an identity that's not shaped by marriage itself, as a grouping that is actually massively disenfranchised in all sorts of ways. How might that new sense come together as you see it?
I'm just like so glad that you asked that question, because my answer is going to be a little different than some of the social scientists who are working in this field now. I think that we have not initiated a civil rights movement because we have a troubled relationship to history. So that after 2000, after 9/11, when in those terrible days after 9/11, when a committee for reparations was put together, and the head of the committee decided to give every married person who had died in 9/11 give their surviving spouse $50,000. Immediately, you know, before any other things were calculated, you know, he was basically saying married lives mean more, but nobody protested because there were no news coverages of it. You had to dig to find that. Well, why? Because we have a troubled relationship to history. Same thing with women's history. That Gerda Lerner started the first women's history program, and she said at Sarah Lawrence College, and she said women are not going to be cohesive as a group unless they recognize that they have a specific history that's different from men. And once we do that, we can look past our differences and see our similarities. I'm making the same argument for non-marital people, and this means prostitutes, Catholic clergy, concubines, as they were, you know, called in the 18th century, people like Anita Hill, who's in an LAT relationship, living apart together, people like myself, in a relationship, but I hold friendship as equal to my romantic partner. The many, many friendship groupings now that are now raising children together. Anderson Cooper is a great example. He and his ex-boyfriend are raising a son. And people keep pressuring them to get married. It's really funny. And he keeps saying, we're not going to. We're friends now. We're just raising children together. There's all kinds of exciting new family formations being improvisationally created, but without the historical backing, without knowing that unmarried people are not a lunatic fringe, and we're not a tiny percentage of the population. We've always existed in large numbers, and I shudder to think where we'd be without non-marital people like Isaac Newton. We would not know the laws of gravity. If it weren't for Mendel, the monk who discovered genetics, by living in a monastery and looking at apples and, you know, fruit and how they different generations of fruit changed over time, he figured out how recessive genes worked. We wouldn't know genetics. We wouldn't have pop art. We wouldn't have Andy Warhol and the whole art movement that he spawned. Or for him, a guy like Joshua Reynolds, who ran a similar kind of factory in 18th century Britain and was a great portrait painter, and he lived with his sister, which was a very common arrangement. She was also a very fine portrait painter. That was a common 18th century thing. As siblings, they lived together for like 25 years and painted. No one asked why he wasn't married. He was giving so much to the British art culture of the time. The contemplative tradition, the religious contemplative tradition that includes people like Buddha and dare I say, Jesus, is amazing and wouldn't exist if all these individuals had been married. I think of Hannah Senesch, the pilot who flew behind Nazi lines in World War II was captured and killed, tortured, and a terrible story. But she was unmarried. A lot of the most unconventional military women and women writers were not Virginia Woolf, but I'm thinking of Jane Austen, people like Barbara Pym. So many women writers have struck out on their own path and needed the time, the privacy, and the independence, and the quiet to write, and marriage wouldn't have worked for them. You know, we wouldn't have Jane Austen's six novels, which are perhaps the most perfectly economical novels in English, if she had married her suitor, Frank Lefroy, you know, it didn't work out. But anyway, I'm quite happy to have the novels, and I feel that there's just the arts, the sciences, the incredible activism of people like Maggie Kuhn, who fought ageism. She challenged the 65-year-old retirement requirement, and whenever she was asked why she didn't have a husband, she just said pure luck. she lived with two. She created two households in Philadelphia of friends, and lived between the two of them, and had an affair with a sexual affair with a much younger man. I think she was in her 80s and he was in his 20s. And the non-married creative people, let's remember them and remember them as a force. And I think if we can start talking to them through past the generational barrier and talking to each other as a group that shares disadvantages in marriage-dominated societies, we can get to a place where we can start to make demands that are reasonable, that we have equal immigration and health insurance rights. That history is where I find empowerment.
Jacqueline Geller, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Sasha. Thank you for interviewing me.
Jacqueline Geller is Associate Professor of English at Central Connecticut State University. We've been discussing her book, Moving Past Marriage, Why We Should Ditch Marital Privilege and Relationship Status Discrimination and Embrace Non-Marital History. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.